is Castle One. Race officer speaking.
Pressure coming here, pressure coming.
We're 1.5 below.
2 dives here, boys. We're looking at 10.5 and 42.
Hello, podcast listeners. Thanks again for joining us on the pod. I do hope you all enjoyed part one of our Vendée preview edition. If you haven't checked out part one, maybe jump back and give it a go first. We speak to British Vendée veteran Alex Thompson, who's about to embark on his fifth push for the title. Clarisse Kremer, a race rookie who has been handpicked to represent one of the most successful stables in the game, Banque Populaire, the winners of the last edition. And if you're at all intrigued by the machines themselves, we explore the design game of a 2020 Amoca 60 with Argentinian naval architect Juan Cumajon, a man with a reputation for pushing design boundaries. He's not sailing in the race, but his insight into the fleet is really fascinating. In this pod, though, we chat to three sailors. Boris Herrmann, the first German to enter this very French race. He's the sailor who shot to global fame after offering Greta Thunberg a lift across the Atlantic in his Amoca. We talked to Charlie Dallin, a Vendée rookie, but a rookie with the pedigree, the boat and the preparation to see him mixing it up in the battle for the elusive podium finish. And we kick things off in this edition with a podcast milestone. We've been making the pod now for around 18 months, and our first chat this month is with our very first repeat guest. We interviewed Sam Davies back in July last year. With 16 months to go until the Vendée start, I mean, she was excited and looking forward to her third Vendée start. So we thought we'd catch up to see how it's all gone. As I said in part one of this podcast, we're desperately disappointed not to be at the start itself for this edition. It's a fantastic occasion. I will never forget motoring down the famous canal in the Sable d'Olonne, listening to thousands upon thousands of adoring French sailing fans chanting Sam's name. Samantha, Samantha. It was an extraordinary occasion. But it was great to catch up and hear how excited she is for the challenge. I hope you enjoy part two of the time I spent with the 2020 Vendée Globe.
We haven't done enough racing yet with these fully foiling boats. For me, even if it reduces by 5% the chance of hitting something, then I'm taking it. We're all going to be kind of going in there as foiling Southern Ocean rookies.
We start this edition with a sailor that I've known for over 25 years. Back then, it was quickly obvious that Sam Davies was destined to do something extraordinary in ocean racing. She's never happier than in our musto dry smog. She's technically all over it, and she can get out the tools and fix stuff. And crucially in this race, she's experienced enough to play her own game. Sam Davies is about to take on her third Vendée. And if you've been following the media around the race build-up, you'll know she's a real contender. Sam lives in France and has been fully adopted into the hearts of the French sailing public. We catch Sam in an excited mood, happy with her meticulous preparation, and very much up for a chat in English.
Starting to feel the nerves a little bit, but mostly in a good way. For me, I've been preparing this since 2017. I'm really lucky to have had all the time and the time to spend on my boat. But over the last few weeks, I've kind of been counting down the training sessions to go and the sails to go. And so the nerves have started to come in, but also the excitement, because it's something I've been looking forward to for years. And finally, we're gonna make it out onto the start line and around the world. And it was something that we weren't even sure was going to happen at the beginning of this year. In general, really excited.
Oh, we're excited too, Sam. As a British Vendée veteran, but also a French resident, you're perhaps in the perfect place to answer this question. For our listeners, not perhaps too familiar with the gravitas, the reputation of the Vendée Globe, tell us, Sam, how big is the Vendée in France? And maybe explain what it is about the race that gives it its reputation.
The Vendée is huge in France. I think most people who follow a bit of offshore sailing have seen the images of the famous channel in and out of Les Sables d'Olonne, which is just lined with thousands, millions of people. It's a race and a competition, but it's not just that. And it's an event that's known throughout France, and people come from everywhere, all over France, to come and visit. The race village lasts for 3 weeks before the start. And then the race itself lasts for, I guess, from the start until the last competitor finishes over four months. So that's a long time for the French public to follow. It's huge. All the schools study the Vendée Globe whilst it's happening. And I think that, well, there's a lot of legends that have come out of the Vendée Globe. And maybe the reason why it's so huge is because it's so simple at the same time as being so hard and such an extreme event, because it's just one person on a boat sailing around the world nonstop without assistance. And so it's really easy for even non-sailors or people who don't really care about sailing or sport to understand this adventure of being one person on your own on a boat and getting all the way around the world.
Sam, you've done the race twice before. I mean, a fantastic fourth place in your first race and a shattering early dismasting in your second race. You know, how do you feel your build-up's gone? You did well in the Vendée Arctique. Fourth place, but in the real leading group, just over an hour behind the leader after racing over 3,000 miles. The top three were all new generation, running the big new foils. Bayou Chiral, of course, winning that one. I mean, how do you feel the build-up's gone?
Just about perfectly. Given all the situations that we had to deal with this year, because obviously the Vendée Arctic race was to replace two transatlantic races. So I guess the one negative point is that the whole fleet has sailed less miles than planned, because we should have sailed backwards and forwards across the Atlantic. But having said that, I was lucky enough to have had the boat since 2017 and done lots of miles anyway. The Vendée Arctic race was a great race because we had all kinds of conditions. We went up really far north, further north than we'll go south to get around Cape Horn. And so we've tested ourselves and our boats in freezing conditions as well as in strong winds and North Atlantic sea states. It was really tiring. It was a bit like doing a Figaro leg, a 10-day long Figaro leg in the Mocha 60s. And there were so many sail changes. It was really exhausting. But for me, it was great because I think the one major thing that came out was it's the first time I've done a race and I haven't had a single problem on my boat. And it makes such a difference to be able to concentrate completely on the racing and on the strategy, the tactics, the weather, dealing with yourself and looking after yourself so that you're capable of doing all the manoeuvres and you've got enough energy to do them. And just not having to go and scrabble around the back of the boat to bail out a bucket of water every 4 hours. Just everything in my boat was perfect. It was dry, nothing went wrong. And it just makes a huge difference. So yeah, my team had done a really good job. And that's a good sign going forward to the Vendée. The boat worked really well. And I guess the other great thing was that I found myself in a little group of boats that I was hoping to find myself with. And they're the modified older generation boats like Initiative Care, so PRB, Boris Herman, and MACSF, Isabelle Joshk. We've got this little group of the four of us with boats that go similar speeds and really good sailors. It's great to find a race within the race and some people to pace myself with. And it was great to come out at the top, and beat them all in the end. But it was a really good battle with all three others, and that's kind of what I'm looking for the Vonda as well. So it's good to know where you stand, because when you set off with a 30 boat fleet and 8 brand new boats, I think it's easy to get lost in terms of knowing whether you put your foot on the floor or not, and where you are relative to the fleet. And so now I know my direct competitors and the ones I want to sail with.
Let's talk foils then, Sam. I mean, obviously a big topic throughout the sport. Firstly, in an older boat that's remodeled to foil, how easy a redesign is that? And how easy has it been to make your boat a foiling Imoca?
Well, I guess I give the credit to Jeremy Bayou, because he's the one who put foils on the boat in the first place with Nick Holroyd's design. And then I was lucky enough to be able to persuade, well, actually Guillaume Verdier pretty much told me that he would design new foils if I had enough budget. And so I think if you've got the right people involved, then it's a great project to take on, and it's good to be able to prove that it's possible. We were one of the first boats to do it, and now MACSF, well, Militia's got Boris, has got his second set of foils, PRB as well. But obviously there are limits to our old boats that stop them from going just as fast as new boats. There's various different reasons for that. I guess the hull shape, we have tilt in the keel, which in the end was designed for boats to be going slower, and so now our boats are going faster. We've kind of got too much tilt, which means that creates drag at higher speeds, and so that's one of the reasons that slows us down a little bit. But it's really been interesting, and I was lucky to have Anne-Claire Lebert, who's you must know from match racing circuits a while ago, who's a very good sailor and a really good engineer. And so she's works in our team, Initiative Care. And she kind of centralised the design with Guillaume Verdier. And then once we got the boat on the water, working with Paul Meyer, who is a Route de Rhum winner from 2018, and a few experts, and one of the people who really helped us, who came in just for a couple of days sailing, is Benjamin Muhl, who's one of the design team in the Benz Ineos America's Cup campaign. And so it's amazing from time to time get some real experts who've got a lot of foiling experience, who maybe aren't quite so used to waves and heeling over. There's even new things for them, but it's good to have their advice, and that's kind of speeds up our learning curve a lot.
Without then being a bespoke foil build, how competitive can you be against the likes of Chiral or Linktow, you know, the newer foiling designs?
Well, I'm lucky enough to be able to be training with them, because we train together as a group at Port La Fouet with the Paul Finistère Corso Large team, and also sometimes in Lorient, because we're dock neighbours, and so occasionally we go out two or three boats at a time. So I can see the difference, and there's definitely a difference between the new boats and my boat. One of the biggest differences is that they take off on their foils at lower speeds and lighter winds. So one of the big gaps is when they get foiling and they lift out and reduce their drag, and can sheet on, and so they take off before me, and that's one of the big differences. And then some of the average speeds, well, depending on sail angles, but some of the average speeds, especially I think reaching and tight reaching in I was going to say easy conditions. When you're fully foiling, as soon as sea state comes into play, then everything evens out a bit more. There's definitely differences, and I can see that. But the same way, there's a big difference between my boat, Boris's boat, the boats that have put latest generation foils on, compared to the 2016, so the the last generation or the first generation of real foiling boats. So it's definitely been worth it putting these new generation foils on, because that's made a big difference as well.
Well, a few editions ago, I mean, maybe going back 12 years now, canting keels became a big thing in the open 60s as they were then. If you look back at the history of retirements, before that time, it was all dismastings and rudders. And as hydraulic keels became the thing, it was lost keel or keel problems suddenly became the prevalent reason for retirement. So with that in mind, how much of a liability are foils? And do you think they bring a greater possibility of technical issues or collisions?
It's a very technical question. For sure, the foils mean that there's a wider area of boat in the water. Although sometimes when you take off, you could say as well that you can avoid hitting things with your hull because you're flying over the top of certain things. But I think in general, with a foil sticking out the side, for sure there's more of you, or the probability must be increasing in terms of bumping into things in the water. But having said that, we're also developing as fast as we can a system to detect objects floating in the water, and a lot of the fleet are now equipped with OSCAR, which is a camera on the top of the mast, which has got an infrared camera and a visible camera. And that is, it's a system that's been developed over the last couple of years with, so there's a lot of learning from the data that's been recorded during all the transats and all the sailing, to teach the machine to understand what's a danger and what isn't for the boat. So there's developments to try and avoid that. At the end of the day, I think we're going to discover the answer to your question over the next few months in the Vendée, because we haven't done enough racing yet with these fully foiling boats. And the boats in 2016, the Imokas, were designed to work at pretty high performance even without the foils. But this latest generation of boats have taken the step up, saying, okay, it's confirmed, the Vendée Globe in 2016 confirmed that the foiling boats win. So now we're going to step up and say, okay, well, we're sure to be foiling. And so if you lose your foils, then the boat is really, the performance is really reduced. So obviously, yeah, if people have issues with their foils, then that kind of puts them out of the game straight away.
I've got to ask quickly about OSCAR. I mean, if you're doing 20, 30 knots, Sam, how much notice do you get that, you know, the OSCAR spotted something in the horizon?
Not enough, to be honest. If you're doing 30 knots and you're asleep in your bunk, then not enough. If you're asleep with your remote control, then potentially, if you trust OSCAR enough, you could press bear away 30 degrees, and if the alarm goes off, and that would probably mean you would avoid the collision. So at certain speeds, and it's also already been confirmed by various sailors that they have avoided things thanks to the alarm going off with OSCAR. And for me, even if it reduces by 5% the chance of hitting something, then I'm taking it. Given how much we spent on the foils, then I'm trying to protect them as much as I can. And it's a part of a development. And the real aim is to have OSCAR connected to our autopilot. At the end of the day, if the skipper doesn't react in time, then the autopilot will avoid a collision. But sadly, that was one of the developments that has been really slowed down with the COVID-19 situation. And in theory, that was a development that was going to be just about in its first test period for the Vendée. And I was planning to have that autopilot on board, but unfortunately, it's not ready.
Let's talk about the performance aspect. I mean, you went round in 95 days in Roxy. The current race record set last time by Armel Laclèche is now 74 days, of course. How much are you looking forward to sailing in the south on foils? And what sort of time do you think you could do the race in? Or perhaps what sort of times could we see across the fleet?
By the time is a good one, because that was something that I've been working on, how to set my objectives and my aims for the Vendée Globe. And it's really hard to say I want to make it on the podium, I want to get in the top 10, because it really depends on what happens during the race, and how many people finish, and breakages, etc. One of my real objectives is to try and beat Armel's time. As our objective with Initiative Curl was to try and do the optimization process that at the end of, or when I set off for the Vendée, that she's a faster boat than the 2016 generation of foilers. And I think we've achieved that as a team, technically. And so there's no reason why I can't theoretically beat Armel's time. So for me, that's one of my main objectives. I'm really looking forward to going and trying out my boat in the Southern Ocean. I'm sure there'll be some scary moments, but I think there'll be some great fun moments as well. And that's part of the real interesting challenge for this Vendée, is because none of us have actually done it yet. And so in a way, it kind of puts everyone at an even level, because we're all going to be kind of going in there as foiling Southern Ocean rookies, and kind of learning as we go. I think it's really interesting, and I'm looking forward to it with my boat, because, and maybe whilst some of the development, I actually said, no, stop, that's enough, I don't want any more, because I'm not sure if it's reasonable going into the Southern Ocean with something more powerful than that. I'm looking forward to it, and seeing whether what I think's reasonable really is, or whether you can actually go with more and have more power and handle the violence and the stress.
Well, we can't go without talking quickly about your charity sponsorship setup. I mean, you explained last time, it's such a great model. Your sponsors donate more to the charity, Initiative Coeur, the life-saving charity, as your social media followers go up, the more exposure that you get. I mean, it's such a good idea, so simple, but so brilliant. I mean, is that still on track, Sam? Financially, it's obviously a very different landscape now. So how's all that going, and how can our listeners help out with that?
It's still fully on track, and thanks, Shirley, because you explained it really well. It's really simple. It's called One Click, One Heart. So that's the translation, Un Clic, Un Coeur. It's a campaign that will start just before the start of the Vendée Globe. And when the campaign starts, for every new follower on our Initiative Coeur social media, so the Facebook and the Instagram, my three sponsors, Initiative, K-Line and Vinci Energy, all donate €1. For every comment and for every share, they do the same. So pretty much every time there's a click on our social network, there's €3 going into a pot that goes towards saving kids' lives, who suffering from heart defects, who live in countries that can't treat them in their country. And it costs €12,000 to save one kid's life. So every time I raise €12,000, thanks to the public and my sponsors, then there's a family that's going to get a phone call from France saying, okay, we're going to take your kid, and she's going to have the heart surgery that's going to save their life. And so, it's a project that I'm really proud of. Proud to be part of, and it's an extra motivation when you have a hard day. I just look at my sail and I see the little photo of Ardesha, who's one of the girls that the project saved in the past, and it kind of motivates me to keep going. Whether I've just been overtaken by someone or something's broken and I've got to fix it, it's a really good motivation, and it's a great project. So for all the listeners, it's really simple. Just come onto our social media just before or during the race and persuade all your friends to do so. And every time you click, share, follow, or send a comment, then my sponsors will donate more money.
Come on, podcast listeners. I think we can manage that as we follow you around the globe. Sam, it's so good to catch up. Finally, what about your competitors? Let's talk form. Who's up there this time around? Who's going to be racing at the front of the fleet?
From what I see, I guess the boats have got the biggest lead in terms of training and experience and time on the water and breaking things and fixing them and making their boat more reliable. The people or the skippers I've been training with in Port Lafroy, and that's Cheryl, linked out to so Jeremy Bayou, Thomas Rouillon, Charlie Dallin at Pivia. They were the three on the podium in the Vendée Arctic race. So I guess they're probably the three that are considered the most favourites for now, because they're the ones that have been seen. There's a few question marks, obviously, especially Alex, because he's stuck in England. And I know he did try and come and train with us, but we were looking forward to seeing him with us in Port Lafroy, but obviously with the health situation, I don't think that was possible for him to come over to France. So so he's a mystery. I think the French they've been doing as much spying on the internet to see if they can see pictures and videos of how he's been training, but I think he's kept all that quite secret from what I hear and see. And then the boat that's probably the most intriguing is L'Occitane, Armel Tripon's boat, which is the only scow in Mocha, which is pretty radical. And from what we see is fast and maybe the future for the Mocha class, or the start of something different. But his project's gone into the water quite late. And so I don't know if he's had enough build up time on the water to have a fully reliable boat. And so he's probably one of the outsiders and probably one of the most intriguing boats that we'll see out in the Vendée.
It's so exciting, Sam. Can't wait. I mean, it's been great to have you back on with us. Thanks so much for coming back. We're really looking forward to following you around in the race, and have a great lap of the planet.
Well, I'll be looking forward to taking some of your podcasts with me, Shirley. Although, disappointingly, they're too good, so I have to listen to them as soon as they come out, so I don't have a very good stock. So if you can hurry up and do some more before we start, then that will be appreciated.
We'll do our best. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you.
More than ever before, you really get the sense Sam's quite confident, well prepared, comfortable with her boat. I know I'm obviously supposed to be impartial, but I've known her a long time. I really hope that this is her moment. In her first Vendée, Sam crossed the finish line in fourth place in a race that was won by a remarkable man. In a time just over 84 days, a new race record back then, it was 2009, Mish Desjoyeaux sailed into the history books as the very first man to win the Vendée Globe twice. As you'll have heard in the podcast, the attrition rate in this race is pretty much 50%. Historically, only half the boats that have ever entered have finished. So what made Mish's second win even more remarkable was that he's only ever started the race twice. He's two from two. It's an incredible achievement. So we were obviously more than keen to have him on the pod. I've filmed with Mish on many occasions. His insight into this race is always fascinating. But sadly, on this occasion, our hands forced by lack of travel options, technology let us down. And despite a great chat with Mish over the internet, the recording itself was below par, which is such a shame. But in his typical accommodating fashion, Mish has promised to come on the pod next time we're back in France. He's a fascinating listen, and it goes without saying, an absolute legend. Well, more and more now, as the sport has become more complex, so you find many of the top sailors with advanced technical knowledge. Our next guest may not have yet done a lap of the planet, but technically he's right up there. He's a trained naval architect, he's a past star of the solo Figaro world, and his project has been masterminded by past Vendée winner François Gabart's Mer Concept outfit. Charlie Dallin has all the right ingredients, and as you'll hear, he has the determination to be a real force in this edition. His boat, Epivia, is new, launched in the spring of last year and designed by Verdier. It's a foiler, and with Charlie at the helm, it's very definitely a real contender. I started by asking Charlie how much he's looking forward to the start of the race and how nervous he's feeling right now.
I'm feeling completely relaxed. I had a peak of stress a couple of 3-4 weeks ago, because I can still see that the job list was long and we had still a lot of things to try to test to make sure it was okay. But we went through this list. Now we have only very detailed thing to sort out, with nothing major. And so now I feel like we've done everything we could to get Epivia in a good shape, in the best shape possible. At the moment I cannot, project myself into the race, because we're still too far away from the weather. We don't know what weather we're going to have for the first day, so I cannot, I cannot really move myself into the first days of the race. So, I'm at the moment reading again and again all my weather notes and making sure my speed polars and sail tables are good and just making sure all of this is good. Answering to all the interviews, obviously, doing a bit of fitness work as well to keep in shape. But I believe the pressure will start building up again in the final week.
Let's get straight into it, Charlie, and talk about your boat. You're sailing Epivia, launched in 2019. What's she like to sail? How happy are you with her?
Well, I'm extremely happy with Epivia. I'm a naval architect myself. I've studied in Southampton University from 2002 to 2006. I became pro sailor a few years after. I worked in Australia. I worked in Sweden, in Thailand a bit as well. And I became a pro sailor in 2011. And when you're a pro sailor, it's something really rare in your career to have this huge chance of having a boat, built for you. And the ones that get this chance, you don't build 10 boats in your career, maybe one or two or three maximum, So I really felt that this was like a huge opportunity for me. So I really completely dived in the design process with Guillaume Verdier, with the team, working on any aspect, being part of all the meetings. I also had my input in the design as well. The completely enclosed cockpit is my idea. I push for this. The winch configuration as well, and few other things. And basically, Epivia is, I believe, to a certain extent, to my image. My way I imagine sailing, the way I sail, and it's a boat which we wanted to be readable. It's a boat we wanted to be as light as possible. It's a boat we wanted to be an all-around boat. We didn't focus on a certain point of sail. We wanted the boat. Didn't matter if the boat was not the fastest at a certain point of sail. But what we wanted is a boat which was fairly easy to get going, and a boat with no dent in the polar. You see what I mean? So I think that's what we achieved. So I'm pretty happy. I'm really happy with the boat with the PVR it is now. So.
Can you maybe put into words, what are these new generation foiler Amokas like to sail? I mean, fully powered up in big seas. What are they like? Describe it for me.
Well, imagine yourself on the motorway. You've got all the windows down. It's raining. You've got like two big trucks on either side of your car. And it's not a motorway. It's like a gravel truck or something with big potholes, like with big holes on the road. And off you go for 70 days. I think it's pretty much what it is. So, they're pretty crazy boats, you know. When you're aboard a new gen Imoca, you don't need much wind to go really fast, you know, from 12 knots of wind speed. We can when we beam reaching, we already reached a speed of 18 knots. In the last race I did, the Azimut race, in 19 knots of boat speed, I was making top speeds of 33 knots. So it's completely crazy, you know, for a monohull. And it's very pleasant when the sea is flat, but as soon as the road gets a bit bumpy, it's a completely different story. You know, you cannot foresee the slammings, for example. When we're sailing at 70 to 80 degrees from the true wind angle, we already often above 20 knots of boat speed. So that means we're sailing against the seaway. And it's not like a normal boat when you go up a wave and you know you're going to crash down and you brace for the crash, you know, if you see what I mean. Because the bow and all of the forward part of the forward sections of the boat are out of the water, you know, often you sail above the wave, but sometimes, you know, the angle of the wave and the angle of the boat is perfect, and you just hit it, slam it, you know, completely head on, and you've got this huge, you know, slamming, and sometimes you cannot foresee these big slams, you know, so it's a bit surprising at the beginning, you know, because you have to be braced all the time because you never know when the big slams is going to happen.
How different are the modern boats to each other? When you look at the fleet, yours is Verdier designed. And I often wonder, you know, Verdier, of course, and VPLP are the big Imoca experts design-wise. You know, how different can the boats be? You know, and I guess you're an architect yourself. How much of the design is based on what you asked for, on the collaboration and the process?
Well, it's a very exciting Vendée this year, because if I go back a bit in time, the last editions, all the new boats were made by VPLP collaborating with Guillaume Verdier. So the boats were different, but, you know, they were quite close to, you know, fairly similar, you know, apart from maybe Alex Sampson's boat she was standing out a bit from the French ones, but so they stopped working. They stopped their collaboration after the last generation of Vendée boats, and so that means you had to choose between VPLP or Verdier, and also this split enabled other architects to join in. You know, Juan Couillumjean and Sam Manuel. So that means that's four different architects. That's the first Gen 1 of the Imoca's design around the foils. You know, previous gens they had foils, but then they were made for the French boats anyway. They were made like reversible, shall I say? The hulls were very very powerful. We no one really knew if the foils were going to work or not. You know, so they went for fairly conservative hull shapes, fairly conservative foils. And obviously now since then we know that foils are the way forward, and so the architects really went, you know, into the concept, and obviously each architect has their own point of view, and that's why the boat is so, you know, so different. You know, even it's very exciting because even someone who's not into sailing at all, he's going, you know, he walks on the docks in Les Sables, or you look on the pictures on the internet, you know, he will straight away spot the differences, you know. And I believe the fleets will converge. I think we'll have answers during this Vendée and the following races. And I believe the architects will converge to a solution, you know, being either as a hull shape or foil design. But like at the moment, you know, no one really knows what's good. So, you know, this fleet is very different. And I think that's a very exciting year for the IMOCA fleet.
Talk to us about your foils. Can you compare the foil setup you have with the other new foiling boats? And maybe let us know some of the main characteristics of your foil design.
Well, my foil, we wanted them to be, you know, all around. So be able to work upwind, reaching downwind. They're not the most powerful foils in the fleet. The most powerful foils in the fleet, in terms of section and size, they are the one of Sébastien and Simon, the 1K boat, and my boats are more of a low drag, say low solution. They're not going deep in the water, because we didn't want the boat to do, you know, massive bow ups and being unstable. Obviously, as you know, we elevators on the rudders are still forbidden today in the IMOCA class. So we cannot completely fly. So we most of the time, sometimes we actually manage to sail on the foil only, in some very rare occasion, which is pretty exciting when we manage. But most of the time, we still have a part of the hull, like a small area on the transom, which is in contact of the water. And so the trim is pretty hard to control. We worked a lot on the average speed rather than the top speed, you know. So we spent a lot working on different foil positions and actually made the team change our foil position in the very last minute we could, because obviously it's a decision which is pretty hard to go back from. You know, there's so much structure, so much carbon around the foil cases. You know, you cannot just go, okay, let's move it after back. You know, that's hundreds of thousands of euros of work and also months of work. So I was actually more stressed about my foil position than the foil shape.
Your campaign has been managed by the very capable François Gabart and his team at Mer Concept. I mean, I was very impressed by François. When I first met him, Mishdes actually brought him to my attention before his debut win of the Vendée. He's been on the podcast. He's a great offshore sailor. How influential has François been for you?
Well, he's, like you said, Mer Concept is his company managing the project that was the built and also the operational side of the project. What's good with François is he really let me imagine the boat as I wanted her to be. He had more of an external point of view, you know, which is really good in this sort of project, because when you're fully into it, you know, often it's important to sometimes, you know, step back and look at, you know, the full picture, you know. And obviously when you so into it, like I was with my team, my operational, with my team, you know, it's sometimes important to have someone with an overview, and that's what François, you know, did with the project. What's really interesting with François is he's a Vendée winner. He won the Vendée Globe in 2012, and after that, he's also the fastest man around the world solo on a trimaran. So even though his Vendée Globe was with a boat without foils, he still knows what it is to sail alone at very high speeds. And I think the combination of these two experiences, these two round-the-world experiences he has, you know, it's definitely interesting to, you know, I spend a lot of time questioning him on, you know, on the rhythm, for example. I've only ever spent 3 weeks at sea on my own in a row. You know, I'm about to spend 3.5 more times than that. So, and he spent his time at sea, you know, and finding the right rhythm, knowing when to push, knowing when to you know, take it a bit more easy. You know, that I guess he helped me a lot on a human side of things. I had also Pascal Bidegory, maybe you know him, in the team this year, which is an extremely talented sailor. And with Pascal, we are more into the performance, the pure performance of the boat. And so, yeah, between Pascal and Francois, I had a bit of a, you know, I could cover all the grounds really on my preparation, which was really good.
Looking back, you've been very successful at sailing in the Figaro circuit and were part of the Port-la-Fourie Offshore Sailing Academy, the whole setup there, I believe. How important to offshore sailing is that setup? And how much does the Figaro and the setup there help create this great generation of young offshore sailors?
Well, yeah, it's very unique in this Port-la-Fourie training center or academy. It's very unique. You know, it's like you're imagining like two Champions League team, training with each other. You know, that's completely unimaginable, you know, and that's what we do. You know, I spent 2 years training along Jeremy Bayou, Sam Davies, Boris Herman, all these people. You know, we debrief together. We do speed tests together. And the start point of this was the founders of the Port-la-Fourie training centers believed that you could improve faster sailing with other boats rather than trying things on your own, you know, and it was true 20 years ago and it is still true today, and I believe I know when you're sailing on your own, you never know, you know, if you always have this question, okay, it seems like we're going fast, but are we that fast? And with this setup, with this training center, you know, you have cooperation. You can also work on race situation, you know, because we often go offshore for 24, 36, 48 hours. We have a set course, and then there's a bit the tactical part is, and the strategy moves into play, you know, so you can also compare, you know, how you went through the cold front compared to the other guys, you know, and so it's to me it's extremely valuable.
It's fair to say, bearing all of that in mind, Charlie, that you're ready for this race. When you look forward past start day, how exciting is it going to be taking off around the planet in a foiling Imoca?
Well, I like the simpleness of the Vendée, you know. the rules cannot be that, you know, simpler, you know. It's a one boat, one man, around the planet with no assistance. And yeah, it's a great race. You know, the first edition I followed, I was 12. That was the 1996 edition, and you know, I've been dreaming this race. I've been, you know, that's my Olympics. You know, I've been dreaming of doing it for a long time, and I can't wait to be, you know, to be sailing down the Atlantic, discover the Southern Ocean as well. I only know the Southern Ocean through the Sydney Hobart, but you know, it's not quite the same roaring 40s. So, so you know, I cannot wait to discover this. You know, I will be happy when we'll be a couple of hours after the start. You know, when the spectators fleet will be back. We'll be away, and there'll be more distance between the boats. You know, I think that will be a big relief, and And yeah, I cannot wait to get going, really.
What are you most concerned, most nervous about, Charlie? What's got you most concerned?
Well, I spoke to, the Vendée. I've never sailed this Vendée, obviously, like I said. So in a way, I'm preparing for something I don't know, and so I spoke to a lot of sailors. I mentioned Pascal and François, but I spoke to Michel Desjoyeaux as well, which was really helpful. I spoke to Yann Elias, who I sailed we won the Jacques Vabre together last year, and seems like they were all saying that the hardest part, part of the race is the Indian Ocean. There's a French weather expert, Jean-Yves Bernaud. You may have heard about him. He's done several times the Volvo and a lot of things, and he calls the Indian Ocean a tunnel because it's gray, it's low pressure after low pressure, it's bad sea state, and everyone seems to agree that the Indian Ocean is the toughest part of the race, and so yeah, I cannot wait to discover myself or it is really like, or it is really like.
And then let's also ask, what about your rivals? I mean, it's a very talented fleet with some incredible looking boats. You finished second in the Vendée Arctique. What do you think? Who do you think are your main rivals?
Well, obviously, Charal, Jeremy Bayou, Alex Thompson, who, for the matter, he has a very different approach from the French one. He's training on his own. I've absolutely no idea how his boat is performing compared to mine. It's a big unknown. I can't wait to discover, actually. But I'm sure, he's a very experienced sailor. That's his fourth or fifth start. I cannot remember if it's four or fifth, but, he's massively experienced. He has massive experience on the Vendée. He has a great team, a good boat, so I believe he will be there. Also, we have Thomas Rouillon, who has a good potential as well. That is L'Occitan, the Sam Manuel design, which is proving to be really, really fast. But the boat was launched this year, so maybe they haven't as much sail time as other boats, so we'll see. Sam Davis also is I'm training with her in Porlaf, and it's funny because she's the exact opposite of me in terms of rhythm. I'm more of a let's start on the crazy rhythm and let's try to keep going as much as possible, as long as possible. And it's more into, okay, let's start from the end. Let's take a nice rhythm, a good rhythm, and keep going. And so yeah, we've got a bit different way to sail in the Polar sessions anyway. But I think her approach is good for sure. I'm trying to sleep more to pace myself a bit more, but I'm getting there. What's good about this Vendée fleet is it's very international, and it's really good to see that amongst the favorites, there is a foreign sailors, and I think that's the proof that the Vendée is getting a bit more international attention, and I think it's a good thing.
Well, have a great race, Charlie. Let us know how it's going, and many thanks again for coming on. All the very best.
Thank you, Shirley.
For rookie Vendée skippers like Charlie, I can only imagine how daunting a looming start day must feel. But the sense of excitement, the desire to get going, to get the job done. I mean, for Charlie, you can really feel he has a well-executed campaign. And all that's left is to hit that start line and head off around the world. We wish him all the very best. Our final guest of this Vendée edition is also a Vendée rookie, but he's no stranger to the Southern Ocean. Boris Herrmann sailed the Barcelona World Race on board Hugo Boss, and with offshore legend Francis Joyon, made an attempt on the elusive Jules Verne trophy. Remarkably, he's the first ever German sailor to attempt the Vendée, and he's doing it in the 2015 Verdier-designed Sea Explorer Yacht Club de Monaco. We caught up with Boris just before he left Germany for the final time to travel to the Sable d'Olonne.
I'm very proud of the team and what we have achieved. And as you say, it feels like we have, or I would say it's almost like probably the tougher challenge to get to the start than the race itself. I don't want to underestimate the race. It's a totally different thing. But you have to build a project and to lobby a little bit around to find supporters and all that. So starting from zero, that was maybe 2010 or even earlier, 2008 actually. So it took me quite a while. And then 4 years ago, we bought our boat. That was the most important step probably in November 2016. I knew that I definitely going to participate, and since then it was about how, what level of preparedness we can achieve, how competitive we can make the boat, and then we found more partners and talented team members, and we did 9 transatlantic trips and many work hours and sailing hours to be where we are today with the level of preparedness.
You're about to be the first German to take part in the Vendée. I mean, the race is such a big deal in France, isn't it? But it struggles, even here in the UK, it struggles for recognition. How tough has it been to engage the German public and German commerce in what you're about to take on?
It has been quite difficult, I would say. But it's really, I think we broke a little bit through the wall now, I have a feeling. So people ask me now, can we do an interview, this and that? And I said, you had 4 years to interview me. Now I can't do it all day long. So that's good. We have really good feedback. And anyway, media here and the public is interested in sailing for sure. It's just that we never had a Vendée Globe project. And I had to seek far outside of our horizon here, or beyond our horizon, and I found the support then in Monaco, and then ultimately I found also more support in Germany. But it started with Monaco.
Do you think if you actually won the Vendée, would anyone in Germany know what you had achieved? How big a thing it was?
Definitely, we have, of course, a pretty big group now of close supporters that have done a lot for us, that know step by step what we have gone through. We have also a large number of journalists that are specialized in sport, for example, and or that have followed us now the last couple of years. And journalists here know what the Vendée Globe is. It's not yet that you walk through the street and you say, "Ah, the Vendée Globe winner last time, who was it?" Maybe in France that would work, but not yet in Germany.
In 2019, you hit the global headline sailing Greta Thunberg across the Atlantic. How did that come about, and you know, what was it like?
It was a rich experience, you know, on a personal level mainly, but also it wasn't completely aside from our Vendée Globe project. It was two serious transatlantics where we had to make sure that we are safe. And so the Greta voyage was an opportunity for us and a reason to look even deeper and go a step further on the level of safety measures, procedures, equipment, and so on. And also it gave us the extra push to really go for a zero emission situation on our boat, and to really make sure that all our systems work, solar system and the hydro generator system. So in this technical, it gave a lot for the Vendée Globe as well, which you wouldn't think in the first place. But then on the personal level, it was, of course, very interesting to be with someone who is so much in the center of politics and discussions at the moment. And of course, we support her cause. It felt good to do it for the team as well, I think, to do something a little bit different for a moment, to go out of the routine and to think about more stuff or other things. And we had a good time at sea with Pierre Casiraghi and Greta, and interesting, funny moments. And yeah, we really had a good time.
It must have been like having a pop star on the boat. I mean, there was so much interest.
Yes, but the interest side, absolutely, yes. But she doesn't act like a pop star, you know. She is so down to earth and on both her feet. I think for her, it was actually kind of a hideaway from all this media frenzy. And I had the feeling that it offered her the opportunity to actually breathe after this amazing time she has gone through. And she was staring at the ocean for hours and hours every day.
I don't know if I would fancy an Atlantic crossing in a modern Imoca, but it's a good honour. Good honour for doing that. Boris, your boat competed in the last edition of the race as Gitana. She's been heavily modified since then, now called Sea Explorer Yacht Club de Monaco. How happy are you with where you are technically? Tell us what you've done to her, what your approach has been, and I guess, you know, how you balance the risk and the reward element at the design stage.
Yeah, I'm more like I would say, if you compare the skippers, I'm a bit more on the prudent side. And I'm a little bit scared sometimes, so I throttle off earlier than some others, I think. I suffer with my boat, as everyone does, for sure. But I'm really, I would say, a careful skipper. We have looked so long into the accurate alarms for our fiber optics in the foils, and we are really making sure that this is all 100% as well scientifically proven as we can, together with the architect. So these, everyone has a little bit different scale there. You know, if you are Jeremy Biou and Charal, and you're doing it the fourth time, you already have been third or something like that. Now you have to win. That's a totally different pressure than mine. I want to arrive and play a good part in the race as well. So that's why I felt it was important to put foils in the boat, bigger foils. And we already had foils. The boat was already quite fast on some angles, but then. The step was newer, bigger foils. I didn't want to compromise my confidence in the boat. So I knew if I do that, then I go all the way. I put everything in it. I make the whole boat stronger. The hull skin, we changed how that was made. We put more bulkhead stringers and stuff like that. So it was a huge modification that we had to do at the end.
How does she fit in the lineup? I mean, who do you think... You know, how do you think she'll perform, I guess, from a performance perspective? And where does she rank in the fleet? Just give us a feeling of where she fits in.
I think she is one of the boats, of the 10 boats that could podium the race. You know, we have 8 new boats, and then we have 3, 4 transformed generation boats, prior generation boats that have different foil concepts, but kind of modern foils. Initiative Coeur and PRB, I think, are in a similar zone like us. And we compete a lot with them in the past. But in certain conditions, we can also stick with the newer boats and challenge them. And I hope to make it as hard as possible for them and stick and not fall too far behind. The difficult moment actually will be like the medium wind, the marginal foiling conditions. So everyone who is involved in some sort of foiling knows that there's this marginal step where you just have quite enough wind to get going and jump on the foil. And that's the big advantage of the very new boats. They do that a little bit earlier. So if we have like 12 knots of wind, we maybe just dragging the hull through the water still, and they already start flying and go away. If that's for 2-3 days around, let's say, the Portuguese coast or on the way to the Cape Verdes or whatever, then the race could be already over in that sense in this region, or at least we could see massive separations.
Describe for us, Boris, what it's really like on the foils, you know, in a big sea. Describe the sensation of living and breathing that on board.
The noise is amazing. We work hard trying to get rid of the humming noise on the keel and the foils. Every sailor knows that if you like kind of sand it really meticulously, you can get better with that. But we couldn't get totally rid of it. So it makes like a high-pitched humming noise, which also has something positive, because if the pitch goes up, you know, the boat goes faster, and that makes you happier. And, you know, at a certain angle, the boat has this fantastic balance, so it's pushed onto the foil, and it's really like popping a bit, rocking a bit back and forwards, and for a short moment touching the water with the bow and the stern, and then suddenly a little bit more breeze, and the hull doesn't touch the water anymore at all. So we have that, especially, of course, on flat water with, let's say, 80-degree truant angle, 18 knots. The boat is just fully foiling and can go significantly faster than the wind. It can be 28 knots at that stage. And that is just incredible. And you feel the power of the machine. It is a bit scary. I look immediately at the foil load numbers. Are my sensors working well? Do I see the 89% foil load or the 90% that I'm supposed to see now? And then if everything goes well, I just stay in front of the computer and monitor my foil loads because I'm a little bit scared.
What's it like in a sea, though? I mean, I guess that's what I'm really curious about. I mean, I've been like moth sailing, I guess, in flat water, and it's relatively easy, and the sensation is amazing. But you know, you're sailing in the ocean. What's it like with big waves?
Well, there I think is a strong point of our boat compared to some of the other concepts and newer boats. I think our foils have a little bit more of a V shape. So they auto-regulate a bit easier, going in and out with different flying heights. And also the part of the foil that's pushing up is pushed deeper underwater. So it doesn't suck air in as easily, I think. And therefore the boat rides through the sea, through waves, also in a more gentle way. At least that's my theory. And you know, it kind of jumps out of waves and it lands back on the foil, and the foil starts to work before the hull actually hits the wave. So it really smoothens the ride through the sea at certain conditions. Then you can have a bad day where the angle of the waves with the wind shift is such that you really launch off and you kind of think you destroy the boat and you have to maybe slow it down. That can happen definitely a few times in the race.
That must be quite hard on board. You know, landing on waves, and it must be so difficult.
And it's beautiful in the same time. If you feel, especially my boat, I sail it with a lot of heel, which is very different from the new boats, the latest generation boats like Occitan and Arkea Paprec. I see them sailing around almost totally flat. And if they hit the water, they hit it with the massive surface of their hull. And that makes amazing, that must have impacts, must be terrible impacts. Me, I'm sailing at 28-degree heel quite often. So just the slim side, the narrow side of the hull is touching the waves. And I feel that I go through the waves easier, the life on board for me is easier. And the foils are more modest, they are not quite as extreme. I don't launch off into the sky. I don't suddenly sail at 37 knots or stuff like that. So I have huge respect for these guys and their mission to tame these latest generation boats like Occitan, Arkea Paprec and others that have so massive foils. I really don't know how they deal with that.
What worries do you have, Boris? What's keeping you awake at night?
Every screw, every little bits and lashing, and it could be really everything on the boat worries me. So since the last 4 years, I have nights where I wake up and I think of a tiny little detail, and I write it down on my phone. The next morning, I call the team and I, can you look at this? Can you look at that? So I'm really paranoid a bit. And that's during the preparation. I think once I'm at sea, that's a bit better. Then I get into it. I get into a rhythm. I become sometimes really one with my boat. I really feel happy on board and on the ocean. And that's a good thing. I have sailed lots on the boat and I really like my boat, and I'm looking forward to go out there. What worries me is then, of course, that I could do a mistake and break something, that I could have bad luck with some floating object that puts an end to all these efforts. The efforts of the team, you're very conscious of that, of course, as well, once you're out there. All these hours and amazing work that has gone into it, all the hard, the blood and sweat and tears and 81 consecutive days for two of my guys during the corona times. They couldn't go back home to New Zealand. They just kept working, and it's an amazing commitment from the team.
Boris, perhaps lastly, just summarize what it means to Boris Herrmann to be there on the start line in Le Sable d'Olonne.
Well, it's not done yet, right? There's still some threats. So on the November 6th, we get the corona test, and it has to be negative. Otherwise, you're just brutally excluded from the race. So if I leave, or no, leaving, I don't say if, but leaving, I'm a bit superstitious as well, leaving on November 8th, then I will just make a couple of crosses, and I will really celebrate the fact that actually in these difficult times, the race could still go ahead despite the crisis situation, and that I could take the start. And that will be a huge relief, really, a huge relief.
Boris Herrmann, a poignant end to our Vendée edition. I do hope you've enjoyed our look into the lives of just some of the remarkable men and women about to set off around the world in this incredible race. It's a truly extraordinary event. Of course, this year the hundreds of thousands of fans won't be able to line the canal in Le Sable d'Olonne to wish the sailors bon voyage. It will be quiet, eerie in a way. But the nation will watch at home, I'm sure of that. And I hope that we've enticed you enough that you might just keep an eye on the race tracker too. Careful though, it's very addictive. Start date, the 8th of November, 1200 hours UTC, just in case you're interested. If you have enjoyed this pod, please let us know. Like, review and subscribe on whatever platform you're joining us on. Or send me a message. I'm easy to find. Shirley Sale on Twitter and Instagram, or just me everywhere else. It's really lovely to hear from you all. Thanks again to Tim at Vertigo Films for lovingly pulling all this together. 6 people, 5 remote interviews. It really was a big edit. He's worked hard all the while himself away filming. So many thanks to Tim. Also, of course, thanks to our 5 skippers for making the time. We know in this final countdown, time is really precious. I appreciate it. And to Wan K, a genius of a man we could listen to all day. Thank you all. And to all the sailors crossing the start line, we wish them all a safe and exciting ride. That's all from us until next time. Thank you so much for listening. And sail safe, everyone.
This is Cosmo 1, Race of the Speaking.
Pressure coming here, pressure coming.
We're 1.5 below.
2 dives here, boys.
We're looking at 10.5 to 42.
This is Castle 1 standing by. Out.